Hitva. Having given up. Tat. That household. Ipsita tamam. Most desirable. Api. Even. Akandala yoshitam. By the wives of Lord Indra. Kinchit chikara. Vadanam. She wore a sorry look. On her face. Putra Vishleshana. By separation from her son. Atura. Afflicted. So translation, although her position was unique from all points of view, saintly Devahuti, in spite of all her possessions, which were envied even by the ladies of the heavenly planets, gave up all such comforts. She was only sorry that her great son was separated from her. So you can repeat, although her position was unique, from all points of view, saintly Devahuti, in spite of all her possessions, which were envied even by the ladies of the heavenly planets, gave up all such comforts. She was only sorry that her great son was separated from her. So purport by his divine grace, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Devahuti was not at all sorry at giving up her material comforts, but she was very much aggrieved at the separation of her son. It may be questioned here that if Devahuti was not at all sorry to give up the material comforts of life, then why was she sorry about losing her son? Why was she so attached to her son? The answer is explained in the next verse. He was not an ordinary son. Her son was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can give up material attachment, therefore, only when one has attachment for the Supreme Person. This is explained in Bhagavad Gita. Param drishtva nivartate. Only when one actually has some taste for spiritual existence can he be reluctant to follow the materialistic way of life. Itva taripsitattamam apyakkandala yoshitam kinchichakara vadanam putra vishleshanatura. So omaganatimirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshur meritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So Devahuti's renunciation is actually being described here. And of course, renunciation means, as we've described many times before, to be unattached to the material energy, or the Sanskrit word uses nirapeksha. Or another word used is something, sama, to be equal poised. Just like we hear about the qualities of a Brahman, sama, dama, dabaksho, chup. That a Brahman, the first quality of a Brahman is he's just equal poised. And another verse in Bhagavad Gita, of course, is what? Vidya Vinaya Sampane, Brahmani Gavi Hastini, Shuni Chak, Chaivasvapaki Cha, Pandita Samadarshana. Samadarshana. Same thing here, isn't it? Samadarshi. That means equal. Equal to what? Both happiness and distress, pleasure and pain. Matra, it's first lesson taught in Bhagavad Gita. Matra Sparshas Dukuntiya, Sitoshna Sukha Dukada. Agama payanam nichash tamsa tiksha shabharata. Someone should not be disturbed by happiness, distress, pleasure and pain, winter and summer seasons, all the dualities of the material world. So Devahuti was on this renounced position. This is actually what renunciation means. Not that one is just angry, bitter, criticizing others. You know, just in other words, just one doesn't care about the whether one is in an opulent situation, just like that Avadhuta Brahman described in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, sometimes he was eating very nicely. It's described, Prahlad Maharaj came across him. He was very fatty, and he said, you know, and he was lying on the ground. He was just accepting whatever came in due course. You understand? And you're just like, you know, sometimes he lives opulently in a palace, sometimes he lives on the street, and it didn't make a difference to him. So this is actually nirupeksha. Neutrality, samadarshi, like that. So Devahuti was in this particular situation, but it's interesting that she was exhibiting spiritual emotions. These emotions are called bhavas. And this is really what brings us to a higher platform, being disinterested in the material world, because we do have needs. We have emotional needs. And actually, these emotional needs, even in the material world, let's say, like, not even talking about spirituality, if they're not fulfilled, one will not be happy. And if they are fulfilled, then one can live in, let me say, what we as Americans would consider to be miserable conditions, and one can actually be happy. Just like you see in India. I don't know if any of you have been, you know, you've all been to India. But like you go to India, you know, sometimes people are living like in tents or, you know, even worse situations like that, and they appear to be happier than the Americans. Just like I was in Mayapur, and, you know, if you take rickshaws, and one thing nice about Mayapur is the price for rickshaws is a lot less than Vrindavan. I was like in complete ecstasy, you know. I said, how much do Ular got? And they said, 10 rupees. And I said, wow, what a bargain. You know, even in Govardhan, you know, taking a rickshaw from where I stay to the city of Govardhan, they wanted like 40 rupees, you know. And it's actually the same distance, basically speaking. So anyway, so I was in ecstasy in Mayapur for that reason. Shows how much contaminated I am, you know. other people go to Mayapur and they get an ecstasy because it's Lord Chaitanya's place, and I get an ecstasy because prices are low. So anyway, so we have to admit you were not on the highest spiritual platform. with a rickshaw wallet, okay. And actually, these rickshaw wallahs, they're actually great devotees. That's another point, too. They're not just... Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you know, talks about taking the dust of, like, the untouchables in the holy dham, isn't it? The dust of the feet of, like, the untouchables. When will I be satisfied taking the dust as my food stuff? So, anyway, they're great personalities. We understand that. Even the monkeys, the cats, the dogs, and everything like that are great personalities. But apart from that particular issue, I was seeing that, you know, these rickshaw wallahs, they were happy. You know, they were happy. And then I compare that, you know, I go on an airplane with a bunch of Westerners. It's mainly Westerners who are going to India, you know, just to see the Taj Mahal or something like that. You know, what is the Taj Mahal? Anyway, used to be a Shiva temple, but some Muslim, he tried to make it into a memorial for his wife. Anyway, So just look at the, you know, the misery. I mean, in spite of all that opulence, of people flying in jet planes. I mean, the rickshaw wallahs. I mean, they have to take a loan out just to buy a rickshaw. Did you know that?
Yeah.
It's actually a mortgage, you know, a mortgage on their rickshaw.
Wow.
Pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, for us, you know, you buy a rickshaw, you know, well, how much it costs? $100 or something like that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, to get a license, a rickshaw wallet license. Anyways, so whatever it is, I mean, they really, you know, 10 rupees, it's going to be hard to pay off a loan, even for $100. But they're happy, you know, they're happy getting some exercise, you know. And actually, it's an ideal way of life, isn't it? Living in Mayapur, getting some exercise. So of course, one may ask, why are they happy, you know, just pedaling on the rickshaw? Well, even in the material world, getting back to the point, is that actually, Prabhupada actually gave this quote, I think it was some English poet, society, friendship, and love divinely bestowed upon man. Because they have their friends there, they have their family, and, the, you know, the wife is probably relatively chaste in Bengal, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, generally, in the traditional cultures, they don't have to worry about their wife running away with a postman or something. So, you know, they have their family, they have their children, they may be living very simply, but they have, you know, a very stable, loving situation there. And they have their friends, the other rickshaw wallahs. Right? you know, they have their association. They have all their buddies. You know, you see them sitting around talking to the other rickshaw wallahs and having, you know, talking. I don't know what they're talking about. Probably not too much about Krishna, but that's, they're in a holy place and they're great devotees, so we're not going to criticize them. But in any case, so they have these loving exchanges. You know, their basic needs are met. But they live very simply, whereas in the West, our basic needs are definitely met, and met, and met, and met. So, and we think we need more. You know, we go on the internet, and we go to Amazon.com, or, you know, we have to, you know, how many coats do we have? You know, or how many, yeah, shoes. Shoes is a good thing, you know, Imelda Marcos syndrome. You know, where she had like thousands of pairs of shoes there, and how many, sorry, you know, just like even, you know, I got to see the Westerners that go to India, and they spend most of the time in Lloyd Bazaar, and that's in Vrindavan, buying the saris, you know, ladies stack up these saris, and, you know, one of the main anxieties I have about going to India is every time I go to India, people say, I think ladies all need new saris for the temple, they need this. You know, like that. So anyway, so of course I bought 3 new dhotis while I was there. And they cost 1,100 rupees for 3 new dhotis. It was very difficult for my heart to do such a thing. But in any case, I mean, but we have so much opulence in the West, and then we're still not happy. You know, it's just actually increasing our burden. So, you know, and the point I'm making is that actually the happiness even within the material world comes from, of course, you've got to have your basic needs fulfilled. I understand you need air, you need water, you need food, all those other nice things. But, you know, basically in order to be happy, you need to have like a, you know, friends and society, friendship and love. That's talking about material happiness, of course. I'm not speaking on the basis of sannyas life right now. So you need these things. You know, it's just happiness. And Prabhupada talks, so of course, in modern society with all the amenities, the people are separated too. You know, that the families are very much separated. You know, the people. That's another thing. You go on the plane and the people from India are going to visit their families, which they see once every 2 or 3 years. You know, they're going to see their father, going to see their mother, whatever, especially when they get sick or when they pass away. So the families are separated. It's very, very miserable, actually, to be separated from the people you love. Because even in the mature world, you know, the loving exchanges, the relationships are actually, practically speaking, a material higher taste. For example, if a mother, you know, I was examining, like, mother or father, they love the children, they're able to execute so many austerities to make money to support the family. Like, if you ask me, you know, let's say one of you has a child and you say, you know, please go to work to support my child. I say, hell with you. I'm not going to go to work to support your child. It's your business, buddy. You know, your child needs new diapers or something, huh? So, because there's no love there. You understand? But when there's love, then even austerities in the material world can be executed. And they are. I mean, why the parents working like day duty, night duty, as Prabhupada says, or traveling such far, long distances. Because there's actually the relationship, the loving relationship there. So even in the material world, one can become disinterested in material amenities because of loving relationships. It's interesting, isn't it? They can become really completely disinterested because if there's actually love. Of course, in the modern family, that's another thing. You know, the parents are thinking, you know, basically not even parents, people don't get married nowadays. People are just thinking of enjoying their senses, and the child is considered to be a burden instead of in the traditional sense. Traditional families, even in America 100 years ago, that the child was considered to be, you know, an asset to the family because they were more living on farms there. And when you live on a farm, when you live in the country, then the children are definitely assets because the children are going to help you with your agricultural work. But in the cities, you know, the children are just going to be a burden to you. So anyway, I mean, modern society, people don't have so much love for their children. There's abortion, and it's, they don't have love for their wives anymore. It's just wives or husbands, you know, they're switching husbands, switching wives. So that's a little bit different. But in the traditional culture, that's one nice thing about the traditional cultures as contrasted to America. I mean, people have, there's a lot of affection and love in the families. That's one thing I've seen in India. And not only in the families, but there's actually affection and love in the villages. And there's affection and love when they're dealing with, even with saintly people, you know, that there's, of course, there's also some fear. You know, the person's going to curse them. That's there too. But there's actually a very affectionate relationship. When the sadhu would come to someone's house, I was staying at someone's house in Mayapur, and the wife is Indian, and the husband is Western. And the wife was always thinking, you know, can I do this for you? Can I do that for you? Please let me do that. You know, there's more of a loving relationship. And of course, I was just thinking, let me cook for myself, but because I prefer to cook for myself. But it's almost they're insulted if you cook for yourself in their home. But anyway. Almost, they are, yeah. with me, I'd like to just like, when someone invites me for dinner, bring over my own prasadam, because I like my own cooking and my own prasadam better than anything else. But anyway, so, but it's just such a nice culture, you know, it's a loving culture. I'm not saying modern India, there's many aspects of the culture that aren't so fantastic. That's modern India, we're not talking about Vedic culture. You know, modern India is, anyway, it's influenced by so many other cultures, but still, you know, you find with cultured people, you know, people who've imbibed somewhat of the Vedic spirit, there's actually, you know, a hospitality there, and the hospitality is done lovingly. You know, it's really amazing, isn't it? You know, people are saying, you know, please eat more, please take more idlis in South India, or please take more, you know, whatever they make in North India, rice, you know, 10 times a day. So, that's one thing we're really lacking in the Western world, you know, that principle, you know, of loving relationships. You know, of course, Rupa Goswami talks about loving relationships in his Upadeshamrita, you know, giving prasadam, taking prasadam, revealing the mind in confidence, that's the operative phrase, and, you know, hearing from others, giving gifts and exchanging gifts, and these things are all done with great loving affection. And it's something we really miss in the West. I mean, I remember, like, even when I was young, we had Christmas. And Christmas, to me, did not mean exchanges of love. It just meant basically getting what I could and taking advantage of it. You know, just bargaining. And, you know, I understood my parents providing the gifts. It wasn't some, like, Santa Claus, Saint Claus coming down. Saint Claus Maharaj coming down the chimney. I understood that, but I just had a business attitude towards the whole thing. It wasn't really loving exchanges, you know. Even if I said to my parents, you know, if you really love me, you should do this. I didn't care about the love. I just cared about this or that, what I got. It was just like, you know, and then, you know, when we started to celebrate Christmas, even though I was in a Jewish family, I told my family, now we also have to celebrate Hanukkah. So I can get more, you know. So it's more like a, you know, the Western mentality, you know, so much is mine today, you know, real demoniac mentality. A little boy, you know, having been a demon. So anyway, so how much more can I get today? I want more tomorrow, more and more. Like that, consume. And Americans like that. So this is our culture. I was brought up in that culture. So, but in Indian families, you actually see something different. You know, there's actually loving exchanges, and the parents, the children love the parents. I'm not always in modern society, but in many cases, it's like that. So, I've actually begun to appreciate that after all these years of visiting India, working with Indian people. You know, just very much appreciating that that aspect of the culture. And that's then you can ignore other things. You know, like I mean, for example, when you go. When Indian family members visit each other, they'll have like 20 people living in a room, you know, that the size of one of us lives in. Isn't it? I mean, in America, we have our, you know, Mac mansions, which have increased on the order, I think, 50% increase in size over the last 10 years. I mean, I was reading the statistics, you know how in America we're actually consuming disproportionately, more of the Earth's resources. So we each, in a family, each person needs their own big room, isn't it, with their own TV set and their own telephone and their own mobile phone. Of course, in India, everybody has their own mobile. What?
Each person needs
his own family room, yeah. But in India, I mean, they all like living in the same room. It's just like, for me as a Westerner, you say, huh? A bunch of people live. Of course, when I was a new devotee, we all lived in the same room, too. I remember, fitting like 35, 40 people sleeping in a room probably smaller than this and all sharing the same bathroom. And it was actually kind of nice, You just had to watch out, about rolling over in the middle of the night, committing offense against some Vaishnava, particularly a sannyasi. Or I remember, one morning I woke up and Vishnu Jan Maharaj was sleeping next to me, So, but in the Indian families, it's like that. When they go and visit, it's just they'll put like 30 people in one room. And it's just, there's love. You understand? That's the point I'm making. The real point I'm making is that in that culture, which is higher materially than the Western culture, there's actually love between the people. So they can do austerities. The things that we would consider very austere are not austere to them. It's actually pleasurable. Whereas with us, it's just like, ew-wee. No, living room with 30 other people. Ugh. Like that. So, anyway, what to speak of Devahuti's position. Devahuti not only had Lord Kapiladeva as her son, and of course Prabhupada said, mother's love for the son is the highest thing within this world. Not only that, but she actually was a pure devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so, therefore, she was completely attached to the material world, and she had the ultimate in, let's say, the highest standard of love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's how we can become renounced from this material world, by having that higher standard of love. Like even you see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, for example, of course, he was on like the very highest Mahabhava standard. He just neglected his own bodily convenience, and even, out of ecstasy. We're not saying one should imitate this, but sometimes, we would hit his head like that. What we considered a crazy symptom in the material world, one hitting his head on the wall or on the floor or something like that, then he would just ignore any inconvenience just out of ecstasy of love of Krishna. So that's, and the Goswamis of Vrindavan, of course, Hey Rad, Hey Brajadevake, Hey Nanda, Shunokuta. So anyway, let's get to the point of how can we become renounced, because this is something really that's a little bit beyond us, the emotions of the Goswamis, the emotions of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I mean, that's really elevated stuff. Right now, we're not experiencing these material spiritual bhavas. We're experiencing material bhavas, bhava sagara, the ocean of material emotions. What I've seen is the way for us to become detached is to hanker after the perfectional stages of devotional service. And of course, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his poem, Kabhi Habhi Bolo Se Dinamar, gives us some hint on how to hanker after these perfectional stages. He said, when will that day be mine? In other words, you're wanting something, which is called, as we mentioned before, this is called the sankalpa, a desire or some intention when you're doing something. A sankalpa means with the activity, or sort of desire with the activity. So we should actually be hankering. Or another song, of course, is Goranga Balite Habi Pulaka Shatir. When will that day be mine? When chanting the name Goranga. Actually, interestingly enough, talking about Jaya Pataka Maharaj is actually getting much better, and he starts chanting Goranga real loudly again. And I was experiencing emotions too, but it was a pain in my ears anyway, so because it was so loud. You know how they do that? How he goes sometimes? Goranga! But those weren't spiritual emotions. They were just like shocks. shots to the spinal system or something like that. So, so we should be thinking like that as we're performing devotional service. Just like we have the Tulsi prayer, we have Tulsi prayer every morning. You know, please make me a maidservant. You know, as a lowly servant of Krishna prays, may I always swim in the love of Sri Sri Radhika Vrinda. So you're actually asking for something, praying for something, requesting something. So if we do it in that mood, we're not experiencing that love now, that bhava, except for the material things. But this should be our aspiration. Everyone understands the word aspiration, desire. I want this, Krishna, I want this. Therefore, we can become detached. If you want something enough, even though you don't have it, you can become detached from this material world. You can become nirapeksha and do everything in that light. And this will actually give us an impetus to utilize our time properly in Krishna consciousness and not waste any moment. You know what? One thing that reminded me of this when I was in Mayapur was that one of the things I do when I go to Mayapur is I go to the samadhis of not only Srila Prabhupada, of course, but there's the samadhis of all my friends there, you know. Which is really intense, you know. It's my friend area, you know. All my buddies, not all my buddies, you know. Some of them are still alive, but of some of my buddies, you know, some of my friends. So I go there, and you know, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and other great devotees like Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj are there, Sridhar Maharaj are there. This whole area right next to the Prabhupada Samadhi. So we go there, and I just like. Start remembering how, I was doing different things with these people. You know, they were buddies. You know, it's one thing. Of course, we do feel experience from Prabhupada. It's separation from Prabhupada, sorry. But in one sense, there's a separate, different type of taste or experience that one has feeling separation from one's godbrothers, at least the ones that one was close to, isn't it? Because you can remember, I never had those sort of exchanges with Srila Prabhupada where I would joke, you know, and, you know, roll on the ground and wrestle with Prabhupada, you know, because I was Prabhupada's disciple. But with our godbrothers, we do have that, isn't it? We have that. So you go and I would go and remember all these different activities I had with these different devotees, like, you know, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. When he first joined the movement, he would cry on my shoulder because he was getting chastised by some mean old sannyasi. You know, there's different things that come to mind. Sridhar Maharaj, you know, how he would embrace me and we would joke around. You know, he would joke a lot. You know, he was a really nice devotee. Or Tamal Krishna Maharaj, you know, different exchanges we had with him. So you remember all these things, and it's very intense, of course, to remember all these different exchanges we had with. And then you're thinking, you know, where have they gone? And then you think, of course, the natural thought comes, you know, they've all passed away, but it's not going to happen to me. You know, honey, honey, bhutane, kachanti, yamalayam. You know, which is the most wonderful thing, according to Yudhisthira Maharaj, isn't it? You think, oh, they passed away, you know, I'm always going to be able to visit them, and I'll be here eternally, you know. In this body, then the realization comes, you know, that place is for you right there. You know, they save a spare spot on the ground for you. And one day people are going to be coming to your samadhi too. And so, you know, you get that realization, hopefully, after conquering over your, you know, I'm eternal type of consciousness, you know, because I'm eating your raw food and sprouts, you know, it's not going to happen to me. We take our, you know, Amazon herbs every day, or our goji berries, or our, you know, chia seeds, you know, we're invulnerable. So after coming to the realization. So anyway, so we come to that realization that, you know, one day, that's going to be me there too, and people are going to be coming, offer obeisances to me, hopefully they'll clean up in front of my samadhi, you know. put a little picture of me, you know, or something in the samadhi. And just plan, you know, and in mind, you're actually planning out, you know, should it be big? Should it be big like Bhakta Tirtha Maharaj's samadhi? Should it be made of marble, or, you know, you think wood would be appropriate, or car? You know, you actually start.
I pass there every day when I go to my house. Yeah. I was thinking, you know, I'm very attached to my bicycle.
Yeah.
I was thinking I had holes drilled in my bicycle, pour the ashes in there, put the bicycle in.
Yeah, so you actually, yeah, is it?
Cement the wheels in.
That's interesting. So you actually start planning these things in your mind, isn't it? Yeah, you really start thinking about these things after a while. And then I'm thinking, well, I have very little time, you know, so we can't waste time. And generally we waste so much time. I mean, like we're on the airplane, you know, what's playing in the video, you know, on the airplane, in so many ways that we waste time. So that's another impetus. Realizing, you know, we come to the realization, at least sometimes we come to the realization that we have a limited amount of time in this body, and, you know, that all of our friends have passed away, and so, you know, hopefully we're going to join them in the next life if we utilize our time properly. So this is another impetus for being detached from the material world. You know, it really encourages your detachment when you're seeing your friends. That's the nice thing about living in Mayapur, because you pass them every day. I live there, too, in the household area, because I have some friends I stay with. So I pass them every day. I pass my friends there. So every day I'm reminded. You know, like Prabhupada says, he says the renunciation of the crematorium. So I become renounced every day. Just yeah, because I have to walk by there every day. You know, normally you don't walk by your friends' memorials every day. Do you? I mean, normally, you know, here living here in the West, they won't even put you a memorial on your property. You have to go to a special cemetery. And, I mean, just like my father's plot, that means where they put his body or whatever. They didn't actually get cremated. But just like my other relatives who got put in the ground, I mean, maybe I see them once every 30 years. So in Mayapur, you know, maybe 50 years. So in Mayapur, you pass by every day and you're just reminded of that. It's pretty amazing. And of course, anyway, this is another impetus to actually become focused in Krishna consciousness. And also we see a picture of Prabhupada, and remember, you know, Prabhupada was with us and he left this world. It's another impetus. So we have so many things that encourage us to be very focused in Krishna consciousness, even if we're not detached right now. But at least we should be attached to the goal. So this is the point I'm making. So here we find Devahuti is very, very attached to her son Kapila. That separation from her son is perfectly Krishna conscious. And so we should also be emotionally attached and aspire to, or at least aspire to be emotionally attached to Krishna, to the spiritual world and to the holy places like that. So any questions or comments about these things? Apurva Prabhu?
Yeah. You mentioned about this coming to Krishna, and then you mentioned also about the Tirtha Maharaj. So
yeah.
So he made a prayer that if he could take on whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and Krishna, please let me suffer whatever to take on that reaction or whatever to purify ISKCON or whatever. What is your thoughts on that?
I'm not so bold.
That's a lot of suffering.
Yeah, you got a lot of suffering. There's different moods of Vaishnavas. I mean, everyone has a different mood. And of course, that's very similar to the mood of Lord Jesus Christ that he took on. And it's interesting, Vaishnava has such different moods when they leave this world. For example, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada said he left the world because he was disgusted with his disciples. So there's one mood there. And is disgusted with his disciples. And of course, I'm sure there are other things going on, but I can't understand the mind of a pure devotee. Prabhupada loved his disciples. And so did Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and Prabhupada was pleased with his disciples. So as far as, you know, purifying or, you know, ISKCON, you know, which is what actually what his intention was actually to, well, the main thing that caused him pain, I tell you, with Bhakti Tirthamaraj was the relationships, you know, the strained relationships between the devotees. I think that was the main thing that really hurt him the most. I remember that one time the GBC body dealt with him in a quite heavy fashion. What happened, I guess I can tell the story, it's not going to take that long, is that after Kirtananda did his thing, that's a euphemism, and the GBC, of course, denounced Kirtananda and tried to bring his disciples back to ISKCON or encourage them to have the proper understanding. So they asked Bhakti Tirthamaraj to do that same thing, you know, to publicly denounce Kirtananda in Africa. And Bhakti Tirthamaraj understood the repercussions of doing such a thing would have been extremely dangerous in Africa. I mean, sometimes people don't understand that you can't act differently. You should act differently in third world countries or in different cultures. You know, we in the West, you know, what do we call, ugly Americans. And also there's ugly British too, but you know, we actually go like steamrollers into different cultures. I remember, I don't know if I should tell this story, but I'll tell it. Anyway, there was one devotee who I know, and I won't mention any names, that he wants to work in Mayapur, and he wants to, you know, clean things up, you know, just like, you know, just go in like...
He wants to take over with the British judge.
Yeah. He wants to clean up all the different, you know, special ways that devotees have of acting in Mayapur, which I'm not going to get into the details of all the different departments. And, you know, the devotees are starting to refuse to talk to him even. So we, in other words, and he's not American, he's from a different country, but he's from a Western country. And then he's just saying, yes, this is right. This is what we have to do. And I'm thinking, because I know somewhat of the Indian culture, that, you know, huh? You know, to work in India requires a special psychology, and you know, you can't just do that. So anyway, Bhakti Tirthamaraj, he had an understanding of whatever culture he worked in. And so when the GBC asked him to do that, and they said, you know, you have to do it. So he just like was so pained by that lack of understanding. In other words, that's what the point I'm making, the lack of understanding of empathy between the different cultures. He just walked out. And for I think several years, he didn't come to the GBC meetings. And so then, and I don't know if I should tell, yeah, I'll tell this story because it involves me, but then I decided, you know, here was my friend, Bhakti Tirthamaraj, who I knew as Gyan Shyam before, because he and I traveled together, you know, we were very close. So I decided I was going to visit him, you know. I said, you know, I'm going to visit him. So I got warnings from other GBC men, you know, don't do it, it's dangerous, he'll hoodwink you. You know, like, you know, it's just like, like I was going to, you know, get bewitched or something or hypnotized. So I went to see him, he was very nice, and we had a loving relationship. And then I presented the other GBC men, this is what's going on. They said, oh, you're really bewildered. And so eventually, I invited Ravindra Swarup to come there. And Ravindra Swarup was thinking, why should I go to see him? And eventually they became good friends, you know, after that period of time. So really what was paining him, that was the point I was making, was those relationships. He was a very extremely sensitive person, you know, to loving relationships. You know, he was great intellectual, very intelligent, super intelligent, but that was his soft spot. And that's really the point I'm making, that really what affects us more than anything else are the relationships, the loving relationships, more than what amenities we have, more than, you know, the intellectual stuff going on in our little brains, is the Vaishnava relationships. And so Devahuti was actually showing this here. So that was Bhakti Tirthamaraj, talking a little bit about Bhakti Tirthamaraj. And he was feeling so much pain for the pain the devotees were feeling because of the strained relationships in the movement. He wanted to take on that pain so the relationships would become, you know, rectified. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. All glories to His divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Jai Shri Radhagalokananda.